friends. Welcome to another episode of the Tent Laws Podcast with East Forest. I am the Eastern of the Forest. Welcome. I have a lovely conversation. I love doing these Radhakrishna roundtables with my dear sweetheart and partner, Marissa Rada Wepner, because she's insightful, and it's like a great opportunity for us to connect, and she's got a great voice. I mean, tell it like it is. So I know you're going to enjoy this. We're just getting back, so we have some good things to process, and we always try to keep it real as we can and just have a good time. And so I did. We just finished, and so I'm excited to get this one out. We mentioned this in the podcast that the Esalen retreat is going to be opening up soon. So we'll let you know via the newsletter if you'd like to grab one of those spots before it tends to fill up. Go over to eastforest.org and sign up for the newsletter there. We'll probably mention it on social media too, but definitely over on our council on Patreon. That's patreon.com/eastforest. As a matter of fact, the latter part of this conversation, you're going to hear it fade out. If you want to hear the rest, it will be available over on the Patreon. And again, that's a place where you can support this podcast, support the East Forest Project in general, meet community. There's various ways to drop in and support and little doodads and goodies that I like to share. That's patreon.com/eastforest. Thank you to everyone who is a supporter over there. And thank you to all you for listening. Thanks for reviewing this podcast. If you get an opportunity to do that, I think you can do that now on Spotify too, but Apple Podcasts, we could use some fresh reviews over there. It helps us get the guests that you want to hear. And let's just get into this. This is my dear sweetheart, Marissa Rada Wepner. Okay, here we are. Radhakrishna Roundtable.
Take 2023.
Take 2023.
You like your skull?
Yeah, I'm holding up for the visual. Those on YouTube, if we're seeing a clip, I don't know if we'll see this, but I have a skull that was made by your friend in Mexico.
Alberto.
And it's incredible. It's made of jasper?
I think it's a giant hunk of agate.
It's unbelievable, like just how the stone looks, but I don't know how you would carve a skull. It's about the size of a small child.
It's about the size of a small chihuahua.
This is totally a toddler skull.
Oh, the skull. I thought you meant like whole baby size. Like it's like a kitten size.
This is the size.
That's maybe like a one-year-old skull.
And it weighs like, I want to say 7-8 pounds. So maybe that's real. I don't know. Everyone who's like listening to the podcast is tuned out. It's like, what are they talking about? I can't see anything that they're talking about.
Well, go on YouTube. I have a dear friend, Alberto, that I've known since 2008. His family owns the Dreaming House in San Sebastian outside Teotihuacan. And Alberto's a crystal carver, and he does like life-size, giant quartz, fluorite, obsidian, agate carvings.
Yeah.
And it's pretty spectacular. I picked that up for you. I think it was last year when I was there.
Thank you. Yeah, I love it.
I brought it back and you were almost like, that's too nice for me. You said something like that.
Well, I brought it in and put it on my desk here in the studio because I like, in some ways, like I started realizing that skulls and bones and stuff, it's not as much morbid, but keeping you close to death.
Yeah, that's a very Sufi practice.
Well, I was just talking, you know, BJ Miller was just on the podcast. It was the last episode. Fantastic if you haven't heard it. And I've just, in preparation for talking to him, I was just thinking a lot about death and not just like, oh God, we're going to die.
Why did BJ make you think about death?
Because he works in hospice and palliative care.
Okay.
So the whole conversation was essentially around suffering and death. And I know that sounds morbid, but it actually, the conversation to me was about life and just sort of like the present moment. It's very spiritual to me. So this has been inside the house and I love it so much. And I actually just want to look at it more. But when I look at it, it helps me just remember that I have a skeleton, I'm a sack of bones, and that this moment is precious. For whatever it is, it is what it is. So that's why it's here.
So do you think about your own mortality? Do you live with that sense, like, this is it?
Yes. I think we were talking about this the other day, that I don't know if I think about death more than the average person, but I think about it almost every day, and sometimes several times a day.
I think that's above average.
Yeah, we should take a straw poll. I would argue, though, and BJ and I mentioned this at the beginning of our conversation, that I kind of think that almost every action we do is motivated by our existential knowledge of this lifetime ending. And most of that's unconscious, though. Like, it might even manifest as a love for Monday Night Football. Or, like, it's things you're doing to chase God in a way because you know you're going to die. What do you think of that?
I think that not many people think about death as much as you do.
I said unconscious, though.
Yeah, I guess I'm, and so I'm thinking even unconsciously, I'm self-referential, right? And so I don't think I think about death that much.
Yeah.
And so, and I guess, like, is it unconscious that I'm thinking about death? I don't know. I almost feel like the fool in the
What is it that you're thinking about? If you're not thinking about death.
I'm thinking about right now. I'm thinking about right now. I think it's very healthy to think about death. And I think it is a beautiful spiritual practice. And I think, you know, it can certainly keep you on your toes. I was watching this movie last night on the plane when we were flying home, that this older woman asked this woman who was like, the woman on the, she was on like a fancy, rich Russian oligarch, asked the woman on the yacht who was pouring her champagne, like, what would you do today if today was the last day that you were alive?
She's like, drink this champagne.
And, well, she was basically like, I can't answer that question because I'm going to get in trouble by my boss. You know, like, I can't break the boundary of the roles that we're playing now. But to just think, like, what would I do today if I were thinking today was my last day? I'd want to see my favorite people. I'd want to talk to my loved ones. I think it goes down to that for me, like it does for most people. Mm. It's not about the stuff or the experience, but like the heart connection.
Well, going back to BJ, so when I was sort of just tapping into what he's been up to, he talked to Sam Harris not too long ago, the other podcast show. And then I listened to Sam Harris talk to Roland Griffiths, who some of us may know in our audience as one of the first lead and still one of the main researchers for psilocybin psychedelic research in Johns Hopkins University. And he's dying of stage 4 colon cancer, I believe. And it was just this amazing conversation they had about how he's now at peace with it. And not in this, like, I don't know.
Roland's at peace?
Yeah, with dying. And what he wants to do with the rest of his time. And that's kind of made me think of exactly what you're talking about. I mean, all of this is about what it means and what's important to you when alive. Like, we often think to ourselves, I think we've all done the thought experiment, if this was the last day, or if I, you know, what would I do and how would that change my decisions? And I think that is why, like, this skull is on my desk, because that is a very valuable and beautiful question.
So how would you answer it?
How would, today, or like if this was the, how much time? How much time do I got? What's the prognosis?
You're time rich.
Well, let's be honest. I could give you a prognosis right now. It's like, at best, I'm looking at 45 years, and those last years probably I'm not going to be able to do a whole lot.
Okay.
Actually think about this a lot.
Okay,
I was, like, how many good
okay,
years
rewind,
do I have?
Rewind.
This is getting.
I was wanting to ask you, if today was your last day, what would you do? Not 45 years from now.
What would I do? Well, I'm sure I'd do some crying and some releasing. I might do,
like, crying. What kind of crying? What flavor?
I don't know. I just feel like some stuff would need to, like, come out somatically out
like
of my body.
Grief or sorrow or joy and awe?
Oh, I'm start with grief, I'm sure. Just like, wow, I'd have to process that.
You'd be sad.
Oh, sure. I think that'd be initial, it'd be shock. And then I'd have to, like, process it. And then once I'm like, this is what's happening, I would connect deeply with you.
Can we do it one more time? Maybe we could get like 3 in a day.
What?
Orgasms.
Oh my God. Sure. Oh, you meant It. Oh, the great It.
We'd have to do that.
Sure. I mean, look, that would happen. I'd have to make some phone calls and call some my parents. And some,
you'd be multitasking. Friends. We'd be doing it.
You'd have
to
do these things. And I'd probably be like, have to write a will because I haven't done that. And
oh, yeah. All the practical things.
Well, I don't want... I'd have to write some passwords down for you.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
and
give me your passwords.
Help you get into my iPhone. Because this would be a real headache. Yeah. So I hate to say, like, unfortunately, you'd be like, oh, man, I don't want to leave you with a burden.
Okay. That's kind of you to take care of the tasks.
Yeah. You're partially in, like, I don't have a will, but I think I have, like, benefactors on certain things that I've put you down. And I don't know how much that would stand up or what that means, you know, but you're in there.
I'm in there. I get a percentage.
You get some dough. I do need to figure out.
Do you have life insurance?
No. Can you imagine if I secretly did? And I'm like, yes, I do. But I don't want you to know because.
Well, do you secretly have it?
I do not have life insurance. No.
I don't either.
Do you?
No. Right. Mm-mm. So no reason to knock me off.
You know, amazing thing. My ex-partner, Karina, her mother got like a million or something plus life insurance policy on her. And it was
on Karina, her daughter,
that I would get. And I was like, that's a kind of you, but also a bit odd. I've never had someone do that.
Did she?
What if that still exists?
Do it.
Just keep it quiet.
Well, could she have done a policy on you in case you died?
But that didn't happen. It's so strange. It was something like her mother is so funny. I love her mother, but she's in her 80s. She's wacky, old, you know, German lady. And she had this thing that like, you know, she'd say like, you know, do not. You know, I don't want you to like kill Karina and then try to come after her assets. So I'm just gonna basically, she's like, well, I'll buy you off.
Oh, if it, my
you
know.
And
gosh.
I was like, are you serious? I was like, you're crazy. And she's like, well, I got a policy. I'm like, you're nuts. I would never do such a thing ever. That's crazy. It's crazy. It's crazy.
So Karina's got some assets, is what I hear.
Wow, that sounds like a euphemism there. I love Karina. She's the sweetest.
She's wonderful. Yeah. Shout out to Karina.
But going back to morbidity, it's a way of bringing presence into our life. And so I actually like one of my favorite things I see in movies or TV shows is when there's a scene where all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, there's going to be like we have 10 minutes to live. That kind of thing. Like it's sudden and it's shared and it's very short and or it's like a day. I always find those scenes so intense because I resonate with like it's so powerful to think like, okay, imagine in Hawaii a couple years ago when everyone got a text that said imminent missile attack, find shelter. Mm-hmm. Everyone. Mm-hmm. And we people of course freaked out. People were putting their children into manholes.
We almost had a sense of that with like March 2020 with like the start of the pandemic.
We got to finish this Hawaii thing for people who are like, what are you talking about?
Okay.
So that actually happened. Okay. And for all of us on the mainland, I think part of us are like, well, it didn't happen to us. You know, I heard a story about that. It's like, just think about that. And then basically later on, they got another message. It kind of said, oops, I'm sorry. It's not true. And basically some dude hit the wrong button in some emergency center.
Yeah.
And I
think it was like the governor or somebody like that.
No, it was some guy. I remember it was a guy who was a human error. It was not like a decision. It was like a mistake.
It makes me think of that movie that came out 2 years ago that was like the meteor was coming.
Yeah.
And they knew it was coming, but then people didn't care.
Don't Look Up.
Yeah, Don't Look Up.
Amazing film.
Don't Look Up.
But
and that hits on that. Like, what
absolutely.
Would you do? Would you care or not care?
Yeah, and it was very... pessimistic and sardonic. But what I want to ask you.
Sure, okay.
Thinking from a trauma perspective, so something that actually did happen, not a film. What do you think that did to some people? Or was it beneficial because it was kind of a wake-up call? Or
the Hawaii thing?
Yeah. Or do you think some of these people are going to need some help? Like a trauma that they didn't get to like then process? Or was it the opposite? It was actually sort of this gift of like, you actually went through it. Thought it was real and then it wasn't. And that never happens to most of us. It's unfortunately either real or never happens.
You know, there's, I've had a moment, a couple moments in my life where I've thought I was going to die.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And my response is uncontrollable laughter. That's my trauma response.
So you're just like the Joker, basically.
There's two distinct moments when I thought my life was could my body thought my life could end. My mind wasn't totally there, but I was having a somatic response of fear. It had to do with heights in both times. It was like on the edge of falling to my death.
Oh, when you were on that drive?
I was on the drive. One when I was on this Ferris wheel that was from like the 1920s.
Daytona style?
No, it was actually in Twin Bridges, Montana at the county, the Madison County Fair. Anyways, it's like an uncontrollable laughter, somatic release of the fear. And so then making it through, you just feel this great sense of relief, like, oh, whew, like that didn't happen. And then your body is full of adrenaline and other hormones and chemicals. And it's almost like skydiving, too. You can feel that way. Your body has that response.
But that's manufactured.
Sure, but your body, your physical self glitches. Like, why are you throwing your body out of an airplane? There's like a moment where the record kind of skips. And then on the other side of it, it's that big adrenaline rush of like, I didn't die. Also happens in things like Bikram yoga, where it's so hot and you're stuck in the room and your body again
that
is like, Bikram, what are you doing?
Is that guy still around?
Yes. You don't die in the class. So your body thinks it's going to faint and pass out and you'll die. And then you get a big high afterwards. So I think that is what tends to happen is when you survive, it's a big rush.
Yeah, I hear that initially, but going back to my question, as like a trauma therapist yourself, what do you think happened to an entire state that went through every single person? Well, let's say 50% got the text, I don't know, but thought, oh my God, North Korea has launched missiles at it and they're on their way. They're in the air.
I think I am answering it. I think that there's a big sense of relief. You're like, phew, like that, like almost like a more like, let's party, like, or let's go enjoy the things that we do. It's like a high. You get, you know what I'm talking about.
It's a near-death experience. Well, near-death experiences are one of the only ways we typically change. It's like divorce, bankruptcy, near-death. There's only a handful of things that, you know, from a psychological standpoint, actually equate to big change for
or
people.
The psychedelic experiences, which can touch on NDEs,
all
and you
those.
Come out and you think, humans take life way too seriously. We need to play more. We need to have
sometimes
more fun.
Sometimes you have a psychedelic experience and feel bankrupt.
bankrupt?
That's like hitting all the things that you can feel. You're totally right. You're totally right. And
so it's the walk away is have fun, relax, play. I think, really,
that's
truly.
Interesting. So you laugh. I don't know.
Well,
it's
uncontrollable
cry.
Laughter. It's happened a couple of times.
Mm.
I guess you could say, like you said, the Joker, but it's just like, I can't stop laughing. So for those folks that happened to, I guess we could ask somebody, call in now. 208.
Psychically call in our dear friends in Hawaii. Why don't we should ask some of our friends in Hawaii. We know a few. Speaking of,
people are just so jaded. You know, it's like
so
almost
jaded.
Like a
just like
meh.
Give me the next news story.
A little bit.
Amazing.
A little bit. Like from a trauma perspective, right? Like so much gets inundated with.
I saw videos of like a father putting his toddler into a manhole that he couldn't fit into, I was just like, wow. You know, that's real. That's real. Just to try to save a life, or like, you know, thinking just like they were probably just shopping or something. Next thing you know, like, oh my God, where's a manhole? You know, that was crazy.
What would you have done
if I had the text that said imminent missile attack?
Yeah, and you're with me
and I'm right
and
here.
Maya and Benji.
Well, I also would have tried to find, you know, underground. So, I mean, sadly, if we only had minutes, we'd go to the basement, I guess, but that's not a great spot.
That earthquake happened, remember?
Yeah, I remember. I was sitting right here.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole studio started shaking. And it was pretty big, biggest earthquake I've been in.
Ditto.
And it ended up being a low 6 something.
You know who came to the rescue? It was Maya. Maya was like...
Rescue.
Well, I didn't know what was going on. I was in the bedroom. You were out here. I saw things moving outside, everything shaking. And of course, my mind's like, what is Krishna doing?
Yeah. It immediately goes to, what is he fucking up?
Yeah, kind of. And Maya ran in.
First off, if anything was, if the whole house is shaking, that means like I'm pulling up major power tools to probably fix something in your house.
I didn't know. That was my first thought.
I'm just out there drilling into the foundation.
You were to blame.
Experimenting.
But Maya ran in and she said, it's an earthquake. We have to get outside. And yeah. That kind of snapped me out of it. I was like, oh shit, you're right. And so everybody ran into the street.
Yeah. I just didn't even know that happened here. But I guess with all the geothermal activity.
It's the one time that I've known of to that
degree.
But
it does happen. It does happen.
We do live near the Great Caldera.
What, Yellowstone?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Boy, we're really going into this morbid stuff here.
I think it's beautiful.
Ratcheting it up a notch.
People take life way too seriously.
Super volcanoes.
Is the takeaway. Just enjoy it. Relax, people. You will die. You will die. So relax.
But there is a conundrum or a dichotomy there, how we're holding like it's all a joke, but it's all deadly serious, I think. I think like it absolutely matters. And yet at the same time.
What absolutely matters?
Everything. Like everything we do and say and all the choices we make. I really feel that in my heart. But I also feel that like it's all good. I mean, if psychedelics have taught me anything, it's stepping back. It's like, it's all good in the end. Like, it's all held inside this container that you can't escape. You can't fall out of love kind of idea.
And you can never know, really, and you can never figure it all out, really, beyond the one-pointedness. Like, the only...
Yes. The doorway to any understanding of any sort is through feeling, art, music, silence, non-duality. It's the like bridge beyond this dimensionality of duality, and it's like the playground or the campus we're in. It's the language we speak. That's why music is so cool. It's like one of the ways you get to like travel outside this dimension. Anyway,
you made me think of that book I'm reading on the science and sound mysticism by the Sufi musician.
It was given to you or us at Esalen.
Yeah.
I see this lovely soul right in front of us.
I know.
From Portland.
I know.
It'll come to me.
Oh, man.
I want to say Scott, but.
No.
It'll come to us.
It will. I just messaged with him the other day. I was thinking about him.
Side note, we're going back to Esalen June 30th through July 3rd, and the signups will be happening very soon. And we're going to let you know via the newsletter, eastforce.org or marissaradawepner.com, because we really like having... So Esalen's the kind of thing where like it just fills because it's Esalen. You get a lot of people from Silicon Valley who just want to come down and they just sign up for something. And we like it
when it's
our people. It's us. And we're like, we want to be together. And we did that last time where we were able to we're like, hey... Before this goes live, tell us when it's going to be so we can let our folks know so they get first dibs on signing up. And that happened.
Yeah, it was great.
And it was
what
it just felt like Sangha. Felt like
people.
Our felt like we
I
had our community.
I want to say the guy saying that gave me the book was Steve.
Yeah. Had tattoos, cool tattoos.
He was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But what was I going to say? Oh, we also have scholarship spots too.
Yeah, and I think it says that on there, right?
Yeah. So when it goes live, there's a few scholarship spots we always offer.
Yeah, based on need, and you'll see this little application there, just like tell us what's going on, and we do our best to create some balance with that. But looking forward to that, and we went to Esalen. We don't have to go in too much about it, but I don't think we talked about it. But we had a great time there. There was a massive rainstorm. As you know, there's been a lot of rain in California since then, and we were actually stuck at Esalen for about a day and a half. Both sides of the highway were
closed.
Not
that we needed to have left because it was Saturday and our retreat
was
still going. I love the idea of being stuck there, though.
That happened.
Yeah.
That actually happened. It was a dream come true for you.
I said that driving down. I said, best case scenario, we get stuck and we can't leave. And then it happened, but it wasn't when we needed to leave.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful trip. Your friend Teddy was so great. my daughter Maya was there, my dear friend Loretta, one of my oldest friends, like your oldest friend Teddy.
Yeah.
It's good people.
Yeah. Yeah. But the year kept going. It's like, I feel like I never got a break. Our dear friend Peter Broderick was here. We did the live stream, which was amazing. I don't know if we've talked about that. And then we also, he and I finished mixing a record that the one he and I recorded in April, last April in Ireland. And that now is complete, which is so exciting. And then Christmas came and I completely crashed. It's like the year, the tour, all that stuff, just like boom, 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 boom. And I completely felt completely depleted. And I feel like I'm still slowly stepping out of that.
You hit bottom of sorts.
Smearness.
Yeah.
I just...
You hit a bottom.
It's just hard to know. We don't have to get too far into this, but I'm just really in a place of liminality where I'm waiting and watching and listening and doing my best to be patient as far as moving forward with different things, because I just don't know. It just feels like certain things, not everything, but certain things want to shift and not
you
be the same.
You don't like not knowing, number one. And number two, you really love having a plan of action, a direction, a course. And
structure.
Structure.
Yeah.
And so this time having been completed the tour, as soon as it got done, you were kind of like, what am I going to do next? And I tried to tell you, hang on, sweetie, like let yourself have the completion phase.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a difficult place for you to hang out in.
But it's funny, like I can decide that with my mind and then it's sort of like your body has other ideas too. You know, I kind of said, okay, yeah, but I still like... There's so much built up energy, I suppose. There's so much I was holding to get through everything we were doing for many, many months that it just, I didn't recognize how depleted I was.
I think that really showed its head when Peter left, because we really got done with the tour.
That was
we
one of the
turned
things.
Around and went to Esalen. As soon as we got back from Esalen, Peter
like
arrived.
A day later. Yeah.
Then you were working with him intensely in the studio. You did the live stream. Peter finally left. And it's like, that's like December 22nd.
And then it was Christmas. Yeah, and absolutely. It was right after he left. And I had finally, and the whole world kind of stops because it's the holidays. And I was like, what now?
It was hard.
On a positive level, the live stream was awesome.
That was gorgeous.
Yeah.
For sure. And really cool for you to have done that with somebody because you haven't worked in that way.
Never.
With another musician.
Never. Not even a little bit.
You've only done ceremony concerts by yourself as a musician.
Well, let me just clarify to be nerdy about it. Ceremony concerts where it's like a mixture of the two. I have had people sit in like Sheila and Lorraine and so forth. But ceremonies...
Was like a bandmate. It's like starting together.
And
we're
it was a
finishing
ceremony.
Together.
4 hours.
We're improvising.
Yep. Only
we
improvising.
We are co-creating music. It's not you playing a thing.
For medicine was, you know, our intention and taking, you know, a little psilocybin. So I'd never done that. I think part of it is because when you're improvising, and especially when I am improvising for a ceremony, I think it's so much about being open to what wants to emerge, and you're just sort of always paying attention to that energetically in yourself. And I just never thought, I was like, how, man, you'd have to be really in tune with another person just for you to both have that shared wavelength, not just musically, but like what needs to happen energetically for the ceremony. And then it's just multi-level. And
it all telepathically. You didn't talk.
You didn't say a word. And he's the first person, musician-wise, that I thought, like, not only could that happen, but we had an opportunity for it to happen. So I'm glad we jumped on it. It was a lot of work. Just, you know, we had, I don't know, 9 or 10 channels of audio going, which doesn't sound like a lot, but that's a lot of instruments all being live-streamed. So all of it has to be kind of mixed, and I'm performing at the same time. So we had Max and John here, and Max was kind of monitoring the levels, but just a lot to test and so forth. It's not like I just hear it in the room. I'm like, well, I need to see how this is
and
translating.
A multi-camera shoot.
Yeah, John had four cameras going. Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
You set yourself up for this hard shit too.
I know, but I see opportunities sometimes like that where I'm like, oh, but that would be so cool. I don't want to not do it because I'm lazy.
Well, that's the beautiful part of you is you're a risk taker.
And it killed me.
Well, you just, you're a dreamer. And your dreamers aren't wishes. You like make it happen. You see something, you feel it, and you're like, oh, this is going to be difficult, but I'm in.
Yeah.
And you pull it off, which is incredible. You've always been that way.
Yeah.
Ever since like little baby Sir Trevor the Great, you were that way.
Oh, when I was a little kid, I opened a restaurant. I had these haunted houses every year where I had like a dozen of my friends and I had a lot of projects.
You built a boat.
I built a boat with my best friend, Matt. Matt, four boats.
Seaworthy boat.
I mean, let's be honest. We call them rafts. I wouldn't say seaworthy. But
it floated on lakes many times.
Yeah, more lakes and rivers. We never took it on the ocean. It was never in salt water.
No.
But it was a 12-foot boat we built in, gosh, how old were we? Probably like, we weren't driving. So probably 13, 14, 15.
Yeah, who does that?
We started when we were like 8 or 9. We just used the first one. It was just made out of a pallet. With inner tubes tied in, we painted it and put a flag on it. And we threw it on the water, and it was like so unstable. You know, you step on it, it would just flip over. So we learned, and we were very young. And so the second one we built was called the TM Enterprise.
Trevor Matt?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we had flags for all these, by the way. And
that
one.
That you painted?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Our moms would double sew them together, and we had a pole on it, you know, like pirate style.
Wow.
The TM Enterprise, though, was much bigger, more like they're all flat bottom, and they're about 12 inches deep, and then we put styrofoam in certain parts so it would float.
Mm-hmm.
So you really couldn't sink them. And it had a little deck in the front and then seats in the back and stuff. And that one, too, we put in the water, and it was really fun. You had to paddle that one, but it's very unstable because the center of gravity was above the water.
Mm-hmm.
So it also rocked like crazy. So the next one we built, we got serious. We're getting a little older, and that was called the Aquilo. It was wider. I think it was...
Tell me about the origin of Aquilo.
I think we looked up names, and it was a Greek name, and I think it had something to do with wind or something.
Hmm.
And now it's the name of my record label that is sort of underground. It's Aquilo Records. That's where that came from. It's my raft. But I just want to say about the raft when I nerd out on it.
Yeah, yeah.
It was pretty well done. We got 1x12s and we notched them all together. So it had a very strong frame that was now a little lighter weight because the other one was 2x12s. It was so damn heavy. Had no boat trailer, the other one. So our parents were like, it took like four people.
Adults.
Oh, they're like, oh my God, this thing's heavy. So the Aquilo fit. His grandpa had an old boat trailer that he let us use. We could put it on a boat trailer now. And he had an old 4-horsepower motor that we had to constantly put this like oil in every single time we wanted to use it, which was terrible, but it worked. And we could putz around now at about like a good walk pace, maybe 4 miles an hour or something. So you could go places. But because it was 12 feet long and had a motor, it had to be registered with the state marine board or whatever. And so we had to have it was a registered boat with a number on the front, you know, and the license. And it was the center of gravity now is lower than the water. So it was very stable. Had a deck in the front, captain's chairs in the back, all made of just wood. Had like storage compartments, and you could seat another like 4 or 5, 6 people if you want to take people on trips.
Did you ever load it up with people?
I took my prom dates on it.
So that, now we just fast forward or jumped like from 13 to 18.
So it just, that one we used a lot as we were kids, and then it just sat in his barn. And you know, we'd take it out when our families would go camping a lot, and we went out to like Waldo Lake
and Oregon. They would bring this big ass giant heavy boat.
Well, it was on a boat trailer. Yeah, just tow it behind your truck. It's like take it. It's a boat. It's a 12-foot boat. And Waldo Lake was like an amazing place to take it in Central Oregon because it's one of the deepest lakes in Oregon, one of the cleanest and clearest. So I think in certain spots, I'd have to look it up, but like we're talking 600 to 800 feet deep in certain spots of this lake. And crystal clear, cold water, not much lives in it. But because it's so deep, our parents would just let us go out. Like,
did it
all
ever
day.
Capsize?
No, it was almost impossible to. But one time we did take it all the way across Waldo Lake, which took like hours and hours and hours. And we're on all the other side. There's nobody over there. And there was a burn area. And we parked the boat on the edge of a very steep hill right on the shoreline. Very steep. We climbed all the way up the hill. And at the top of the hill, there's these giant boulders. We're talking like the size of our bot, you know, huge boulders. And of course, what do boys do who are 14 or with boulders? What do?
You're going to push it.
You push it off. So we got that thing rocking. And we finally, like, boom, starts going on the hill. And it starts picking up momentum. And it starts, like, catching air. And it's this thing weighs, like, a ton, you know? And it starts moving to diagonally down the hill towards the boat. And it goes, and we're like, oh, my God. And it goes right towards the boat, hits right in front of the boat, flies up in the air. This thing's the size of, like, you know, a refrigerator. And goes over the boat and splashes in the water right behind. And we're thinking, if that thing has sunk the boat, we're talking a 20-mile walk back around this, the lake.
So that was a moment of panic for you.
Yeah.
And afterwards, did you feel elated? Did you get like a definite adrenaline rush from not destroying your boat?
Yeah. Yeah, we had a near-death experience or two actually on the boat. When, you know, I remember being on a river and Matt was, we're going down at a good clip and he was outside the boat. It's just one of those things where, like, you know, there's a channel, all of a sudden it goes going faster. And
yeah.
He was kind of holding onto the side, which is fun, but there was a big rock, and we went right by it. And I was like, oh my God, if the boat smashed into that rock, it'd crush him. Mm. And just, it was like inches. And just one of those just flashes of like, that could have been life-threatening, and now it was nothing. You know those moments?
Yeah.
It goes from like, it could have been so bad, but actually nothing happened. That screws with me. I know we're bouncing around, but like—
Why does that screw with you?
Because after my bicycle accident twice, that's basically what happened. It was so random, and just one moment you're fine, next moment you're in the hospital. Like, it's, that's the trauma. We're going back to talking about trauma that you hold. That's the trauma I hold. Maybe that's why I think so much about like the people in Hawaii who got the text message about the missiles or the skull on my desk. It's because there is a part of me, when you do have a accident, it's the randomness and the fragility of things that becomes very real for you. Very real. I think about, I don't like to think about it, but I think about you dying or my friend's mind. It's just, it's hard for me to.
We're going to die right around the same age. We might even die together.
Oh, this, why? We're going to like take some Kool-Aid?
No.
With the comet when the.
I just know, you know, I have done our Vedic astrology readings.
Ah.
And they say when the Vedic reading ends, that's kind of like your year of death. And so I actually know, according to that, when it is for both of us.
You already told me.
Did I tell you the year?
You said year first, which you're angry about.
No. It has to do with age. And I never was angry about that.
Well, you said it was you and then me like a couple years later.
Why did you think I was angry?
I think you were surprised.
Oh, it could have been that I was surprised. There's no anger, but I might have been like,
how dare I die before you? Yeah.
Like I lost.
Yeah. There you go. Self-righteous to the end.
But
I think you said it was like 80s. It felt a little young.
Well, I think, you know, speculation. It could be something beyond our control.
You don't say. Yeah.
Meaning like it obviously is not just old age. It's like something more global or cataclysmic.
I mean, I hate to say it, but these days, like our bodies and our lives are just inundated with all sorts of external circumstances, whether it be toxins in our clothes or food to the salt lake drying up and spraying arsenic in the air, or, you know, we're embattled. With things that our bodies do, thank you, body, for being so resilient. But it's a dynamic world that way.
I'm so grateful for my health. I'm so grateful for my health.
Me too.
Because not only are there the accidents, it's like the unexpected diagnosis of.
Well, as you get older, I think that comes up more too in the mind, of course.
Yeah, I feel like more people, this is speculation, but more people are afraid of like the random diagnosis than the accident.
Mm-hmm. These days.
Not that diagnoses are random, but it's just like.
Sure.
You're living, trying to be the healthiest you can be. and things just happen. You know, I was telling you how I'm reading Being Ram Dass. So good. I highly recommend it. It's so fantastic. And he talks about his work on the, he was writing, wanting to write a book on aging. And his publishers were like, you know, this isn't really hitting the mark. It's not good enough. You're not really there with the work. You need to keep at it. And so he did a meditation about wanting to understand aging. Literally, he describes this way in the book. He meditates on what it's like to age, and he wakes up out of his meditation and has his stroke.
And I just wonder if that's true.
He's telling it. I don't think he's a liar. Are you calling Ram Dass a liar?
No, but
it's,
maybe
it's
telling
so
a good
cosmic.
Story.
No, but what was I going to say in relation to that? Oh, and he says how when he first had his stroke, he didn't do his sadhanas. He didn't think about Maharaji or God
that
or
I've
Ram.
Heard. Yeah, he was looking at the pipes or something.
Yeah, so it was almost like, ooh, I missed that opportunity to die well, let's say.
Yeah.
And obviously we know when he did pass just a few years ago, 2 years ago now. It was December
2019.
December 22nd, 2019.
Years.
Gosh, it's already been 3 years. Mm-hmm. He did have that focus in his death of...
Well, I think he said when that happened to him with his stroke, he's like, wow, I have more work to do.
Yeah, I have more work to do.
And he did more work, that's for sure.
Decades more work.
There are plenty of people I know, like Trudy Goodman has said, that she actually didn't really vibe as much with Ram Dass pre-stroke. And then post-stroke, they just fell in love.
Or she became, fell in love
even more.
It was, he describes it again in the book, where it was more of just the loving awareness all the time, living with Maharaji all the time. And so much was taken away, of course, too.
And through suffering.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
It was very real in that way.
I remember the last time we saw him in Maui, that retreat early December, a couple weeks before he passed, and that opening night, he came out and just giving like darshan. He doesn't even say anything, and it was like cosmic, psychedelic, timeless stillness, love portal. I don't even know. It was so beautiful.
I remember that.
Just full. It was just thick. With,
I honestly think that came from an entire room in rapt attention and presence.
Well, it's a feedback loop.
But it was co-created. You know, everyone's giving their attention so beautifully.
And
to
he's
that
the
moment.
Conduit. Yeah.
Yeah. He was the reason.
So pure, especially in those final years. You know, the closer maybe the veil gets thinner.
Yeah. We signed up, as another side note, the other retreat we're going to be participating in is in August back in Boone, North Carolina. They're doing another Ram Dass retreat.
End of August,
2023. So I'm not sure when that goes live, but that one has a lot of spaces, probably 350.
Mm-hmm.
Esalen has like 50.
Yeah, and I'll be teaching yoga again, and you'll be performing, and lots of wonderful
teachers
there.
Yeah, I might do some
there.
Other things, some little ceremonies and talks.
Buddhism and bhakti blend, which I love.
Yeah.
You know what I jive on so much too, just thinking about that Ram Dass book that I'm reading, which I didn't resonate with as much until the past few years, is just what an absolute bhakti yogi he was. He was so devotional. Like that was his whole thing.
Thanks, Radha. The rest of this conversation you can find, if you'd like to hear it, over on the Patreon. That's patreon.com/eastforest. We're going to just keep talking over there if you'd like to hear it. Check her out. She's a very in-demand life coach and ketamine therapist. And MarissaRadaWepner.com is her website. And you can see if you might want to work together. I recommend it. This song that you're hearing in the background is called Bardos. It's from Music to Die To. And it was recorded in a live psilocybin ceremony. Thank you again to everyone on our Patreon for supporting this podcast. That's patreon.com/eastforest. And thank you to everyone who supports in all the other ways by coming to shows, saying hello, spreading the good word, sharing the music. I love the community that we have, and I look forward to connecting more. You can always say hi at team@eastforest.org or eastforest on Instagram East Forest Music on the other platforms. All right, you guys, keep walking that walk. Like we said, don't take any shit, but if you do, do it with grace.